Hi, I'm Susan Lewis. I sat down with Philadelphia Orchestra First Associate Concertmaster Juliet Kang, who was the soloist in the orchestra's performance of Stravinsky's Violin Concerto. We talked about the innovative work and how it came to be. The Stravinsky Violin Concerto is not your typical violin concerto.
No, first of all, it has an extra movement, and also the writing and the style of it is not like your Brahms or your Tchaikovsky. It's not that big romantic war horse. It's much more of a ballet.
Well, that's interesting you say that, because we've talked in the past about how the violin can be the protagonist of the piece of music you're playing. And I was thinking that that would apply to some of the more conventional violin concertos. But let's talk about how it applies to this one.
That's true. I really feel like generally the violin is the heroic single voice among, you know, especially in concertmaster solos and the concertos that are written for it. But this one seems almost like chamber music with the wind players, with the trumpets. You know, it's so intricately and rhythmically complicated. And I don't feel like anyone is leading. They're all kind of intermingled and dancing together.
Let's talk about the context of this concerto and the story of its creation. There's a famous chord. Tell us about that.
The opening chord of actually every movement, the first, second, third, fourth movements, it's this very awkward, it's an 11th with an open D string underneath it. And so it's a big reach, and it's just an unusual interval to play. So it's a little bit hard to pick out in your ear before you play it, which is what, you know, we do when we're aiming for a note. You have to hear it in your head. This one is just, it's unusual, and it is such a big reach. And so Stravinsky was having lunch with Samuel Dushkin, this virtuoso American violinist, and he said, "Well, I have an idea. Can you play this note?" And he sketched it out, apparently, on a napkin or a piece of paper or something. And Dushkin said, "No." I think it was more like, "I've never seen anything like that chord." No. But then he got home. Dushkin went home and tried it out. And found, you know, it could work. It's not comfy, but it actually sounds very, very Stravinsky. And so he let him know that's going to work, and Stravinsky went at it.
And so that chord begins each movement, but each movement is very different.
Yeah, it's like, I feel like that chord says a little bit of Once Upon a Time, and then you delve instantly into a different branch of character. The first movement, I mean, it sets the tone because it's toccata and it's the first movement, so, you know, you jump into the story. And then because it starts every other movement, I feel a little bit like we're set up to think, oh, okay, back to the beginning. And then it's right after the chord, it's something totally different.
So Stravinsky was deliberately writing something that he thought would be different from violin concertos that had come before. How does the structure reflect what he was trying to do?
Well, unlike the traditional romantic concerto, which is a fast movement, generally virtuosic or, you know, kind of the meatiest tunes of the concerto in the first movement, and then a slow singing second movement, and then again a fast or brilliant or virtuosic last movement. This one has a short and brilliant toccata to open it. Toccata being, you know, a Baroque kind of, you hear the toccata and fugue of Bach, for example, the Stokowski arrangement that we do a lot here. And I really feel like, actually, much of the piece feels like a concerto grosso to me, like a Baroque-style concerto with all kinds of solos popping out, like a concerto for orchestra, maybe. The two arias, the second and third movements, are both called aria, and they're quite different, though. They're quite different in tempo marking, first of all. The first is 116 beats per minute to the quarter note. So it's actually flowing. It's singing, but very fleet and kind of a fast song. The second movement is truly melancholy, in my opinion. It's marked very slow. The second slow movement, the third movement overall, is very slow. And I think the character is the most sincere in a way, the least playful and the most truly grieving. So although there are two slow movements, they're very different in character.
And so as the soloist, do you feel as if you're inhabiting a character?
Yes, I kind of feel like that anytime I play any piece of music. I mean, you're building up a story and it's internal logic for that character and your adventures. But for this piece in particular, those characters are a little bit less traditional and more veering on the side of grotesque or supremely playful or just almost caricatures of the traditional solo hero of a piece.
Well, for those of us listeners who like a little bit of irreverence, it's kind of fun to listen to.
Yeah, I think it's a lot of fun, actually. I mean, the last movement is a real romp. You know, it's got all these unexpected little accents, as does the first movement, too. They're very tongue-in-cheek in a way. And so is the second movement, I feel. That aria, that first aria, the second movement, is both singing, but also, I think, very jazzy and very cool.
When you're a soloist in a piece like this, which we talked about is like chamber music sometimes, are you telegraphing anything to the rest of the orchestra by your movements, or is it just musical?
As the soloist in this particular piece, it is very tricky, and some parts of it go by so fast. The first movement, there are entrances, kind of offbeat entrances that have to join in and fit really seamlessly. So I feel actually that being overly demonstrative about beats or where I am, you know, in the measure, can be counterproductive. I think that in the time it takes to hear and to respond to something rhythmically as intricate as this, then it's almost too late. So in this piece, I feel like we're all just on our game. We're all just, you know, putting it out. And it fits because we've rehearsed it, rather than, you know, finding each other on the stage.
That would make sense, especially since you're not facing them.
That's true. That's true. I mean, we're all always listening, always. But this piece does go by, in some places, very quickly, like a turn on a dime. You know, Stravinsky has that 1, 2, 1, 2, 1, 2, 3, 1, 2. And, you know, so those kinds of things, there's only so much you can telegraph in advance or at the time. It's fit together because we've glued it together in rehearsal.
And when you have a piece like this with such a rich texture woven together like that, is it different playing it with your orchestra from playing it with another orchestra?
Well, playing with this orchestra is always kind of a revelation. You know, I sit where I sit and I hear the sound as a whole. I mean, in the regular, in any concert when I'm playing in my second chair, I hear the sound, I listen, I respond. But suddenly when you stand up and it's literally a foot away from where I normally am, maybe 2 feet, it's like you get a totally different sense of just the virtuosity of the orchestra and that velvety sound that it's so incredibly blended. And so for that, it's always kind of a shockingly wonderful surprise.
In the last movement of this piece, there's a duet between the concertmaster and the soloist. How's that?
That's really fun. That duet I've played with David when he was soloing on this piece 7 or 8 years ago, and now we get to switch positions. And I've played, of course, many times with other solo violinists, so I know that little duet well, and it's fast, actually. But it's also, it harkens to that Baroque influence that Stravinsky had, you know, like the Bach Double Concerto, which actually David and I have played together quite often, too. So there's that added personal element.
Well, thanks so much. It was clearly a piece that requires not only musicality and emotion and intellect, but a lot of energy. So thank you for talking.
Thank you.
Everything you hear on WRTI is made possible by members. Please join today.